The following program may contain subject matter and language not suitable for all ages. If you are sensitive to true crime details or adult language, perhaps you might want to check out some of our other shows on the network, which are safe for all ages. So with viewer and listener discretion advised, let's get to the show.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Murder, Mysteries, and More. My name is Nicole Mancha, and I am joined by my lovely co-host, Alex Mercado.
Howdy, y'all.
And we are joined by our other lovely co-host and wonderful producer, Mike Mercado.
How's it going, everybody?
Oh, you know, making it through.
Getting through it.
What'd you guys think of the season premiere of the Tulsa Race Massacre?
I thought it was great. I was really excited that we were doing that case, so.
I don't want to say it's the best thing to come out on podcast ever, but it's pretty much the best thing to come out on podcast ever.
And speaking of that, guys, we have another case. So if you missed us in our season premiere of Murder, Mysteries, and More, we're kind of doing something a little bit different than we did the past, over 75 episodes and cases we brought in. We are bringing in stories, cases, mysteries that we find interesting that we want to bring not only to the table here so we can have a conversation and kind of see where everybody is, especially now that Nicole has the Gone Missing podcast, the Good Brother has the Good Brothers. I'm doing everything around the network. So I think this is really a good place to now have and explore some of these crazy stories. And we started with the Tulsa Race Massacre, which if you're into pop culture, it was a big thing in The Watchmen. Obviously, if you're into true crime, it has just been something about these mass graves, how many people actually died, what was the property damage. And on this week, we bring another one that I found very interesting a while back. If you're a tier one fan of Mercado Airwaves and Murder, Mysteries, and More, I talked about maybe wanting to do an execution episode, especially about the death penalty in the United States right now when it comes to lethal injection. And we might get to that one day in 2020, the way everything is going. Today's episode, we're going with an execution episode. Old Sparky. But this one is a little bit more infamous for the complete ending of the story. So we won't spoil that yet, but have you guys ever heard of, I know Good Brother, one of the podcasts you listen to, slightly mentioned this one years back. And I don't know about you, lovely Nicole, but what do you guys know about Ruth Snyder?
Not really much, just about the actual story. And I don't want to give too much away because that's kind of the meat of the story. It's fascinating, the whole death penalty. Like, we've kind of set up this conversation for 75 episodes. It seems of we've always kind of gone of what's the proper punishment, what's too much, what's not enough, and if you are going to choose death, what's the most humane and ethical way to do it? So it's a long time coming that we get to talk about it, actually.
I have heard the story before, but I don't know. The reality is, right, like a lot of us listen to so many. We were literally talking the other day and I was like, yeah, I heard this great podcast. And Mike was like, we did this one. And I was like, well, this is what happens when you listen to hundreds of podcasts. It's like something sounded familiar, but something sounded different. But that's kind of what's the cool part of doing all these is that many people cover them, but you're covering different details because different details are important to you when you're going over it. Like the small things on the side that you didn't really remember because maybe they didn't go over it and someone else does because they found it important. So you get to kind of get different aspects and ideas and background on everything.
And speaking of background on this information, I was able to source some of this from Bernard Ryan Jr. from Encyclopedia.com, from Erica Farr Campbell at Time.com, and Becky Little of History.com. I highly suggest you guys just look it up and do a little bit of your own sleuthing, but here's what I was able to find out of Ruth Snyder. In 1925, Ruth Snyder, a housewife from Queens, New York, took a lover, Henry Judd Gray, a corset maker from upstate.
If anything puts you in the time frame, it's the fact that he's a corset maker.
And his name's Judd.
Yeah, yeah. So the name and the occupation are both.
Judd definitely right seems like the guy watching the Pet Sematary instead.
Already married to Albert Snyder, an artist editor at Motorboating Magazine. Yes. Now what you're thinking. She hid the affair for nearly 3 years, but on March 12, 1927, she and Gray planned a murder. After taking out a forged insurance policy, the two killed Ruth's husband and stage a burglary scene. It did not take long for law enforcement to connect the dots, and a few months later, Gray and Snyder found themselves charged with first degree murder.
What a bad job they must have done. Like, this is a long time ago. Like, this was when you can get away with stuff like that. Right. Like, there's no evidence, basically. So you must have done such a terrible job that they just knew right away, no, this was staged.
Well, literally, you could get up, walk out of your house, get on a train and go to another state and just change your name and be like, oh, sorry, no, 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 it's not Nicole Modge anymore. It's Betty Little.
Exactly.
You could kill your wife for overbaking the chicken and say she had hysteria. It was a totally different
she
time.
She fell down
like, twice to my fist.
Yeah.
So, 9-year-old Lorraine Snyder slept late on Sunday morning, March 10th, 1927. She had gone to bed at 1:45 a.m. when she came home with her parents from a bridge party. Long after her usual 7:30 rising time, she was awakened by her mother, whom she found lying on the floor, her feet tied together and her wrists tied. Her mother said burglars had knocked her out and tied her up, leaving her in the next room. After coming to, she wriggled into Lorraine's room. Lorraine's father was dead.
Does anyone play bridge here?
No.
I'm not 70.
No, I used to joke about that too, but once I played, I understand why they get so intense. It's a very intense-paced game.
Yeah, I've seen you play dominoes, so
it's like an intense game.
Yeah, you've seen me beat you at dominoes too, and bags, if I believe.
That's the only thing you took from our Puerto Rican side.
I'm sorry, you have not beaten me at bags.
I have not. Mike has ran on Nicole's coattails for quite a while
that
right now.
That is blasphemous and very disparaging of my name.
I haven't lost, I'm just saying.
The police found Albert Snyder in bed smelling of chloroform.
Don't get too close.
His head was bludgeoned and a picture wire was tied around his neck. The house had been ransacked. Drawers were empty, their contents strewn everywhere, and Ruth Snyder's claimed jewelry was missing. The house had already been robbed 3 times in the past year. Within 2 hours, New York City's best detectives were on the job in Snyder's fashionable home, which 44-year-old Albert Snyder, art director of Motorboating Magazine, not that one, nice, had bought in Queens suburb for his 32-year-old wife.
Motorboating Magazine is one not of the things one you could never get away with nowadays.
Like, come on.
It's a great podcast name, though. The Motorboating Podcast.
Save that, Mike. Copyright.
Right?
Copyright.
We had it first.
Yeah, Conrad, don't take it. So the cops exhausted Ruth Snyder, questioning her through the day and into the night. When they told her the burglary was a fake, she indignantly replied, "What do you mean? How can you tell? It don't look right," said a detective. "We see lots of burglaries. They aren't done this way." On March 10th, 1927, Ruth Snyder claimed 2 giant Italians had broken into her house in Queens and knocked her unconscious. They tied her up, left her in the hallway, she said. Then, while her 9-year-old daughter was still asleep, they killed her husband and stole her jewelry.
What a simple time where the Italians were looked at as the go-to racist giant stereotype. Italians. Yeah, right? What a time to be alive.
The police explained, Mrs. Snyder said she had been hit on the head by a tall man with a dark mustache and knocked her out 5 hours, but she had no bruise or bumps. Aha! Twirling his mustache.
That's what I thought!
Aha! Her wrists and ankles had been tied so loosely they bore no marks. Neither doors nor windows had been forced, so any intruder must have been let in. The missing jewelry had been found under a mattress. Albert Snyder's revolver had been found on his bed, broken open at the breech but not discharged. A clumsy effort, the detective said, to make it look as if he had resisted.
I'm embarrassed for her at this point.
Like, right? Like, this is terrible, guys. Come on. Watch some, like, Law and Order or some NCIS or something.
Sloppy murder. Like, you couldn't have even had it hidden the jewelry at your lover's house.
Dig a hole. Bury it outside.
Yeah, dig a hole.
Literally anything.
And in the basement, they found a sash weight that was evidently the murder weapon. The police did not disclose to Ruth Snyder the fact that they had found a small pin with the initials JG on the bedroom floor. In Ruth Snyder's address book was an entry under G for the name Judd Gray. The investigators questioned her, "What about Judd Gray?" Surprised, Ruth Snyder asked, "Has he confessed?" Bluffing, the police replied that he had, prompting Ruth Snyder's confession.
Okay, guys, we do not condone murder here.
Sometimes.
That being said, do not wear anything fucking monogrammed.
Also, these detectives are pretty awesome. Like, I kind of want a show about these two guys, like, solving crimes in the 1920s to going into the 30s. Like, this seems like a good time.
Bum, ba-dum, bum.
Bum.
For a year and a half, she and Gray had been lovers. Gray, she said, wanted her husband dead. Gray had hidden in the house while they were at the bridge party, then emerged from a closet to bludgeon Albert Snyder after he had fallen asleep. That is literally one of my biggest fears, as, you know, when you have property and you have, like, your own place, is somebody just sneaking away into your closet.
I did that one time, Mike. Way to go.
And it still haunts me.
Those charges were dropped.
We have this, like, crawl space in the house, and I literally made Mike look to make sure that nobody was in there. But when we moved in...
Just nail it shut, because if those nails are off, something's going on, guys.
You put tape on it.
That also works.
It's fine.
Ruth admitted she had helped to make the arrangements and ransacked the house, but she said Gray had wielded the sash weight. The police later found Gray in the Syracuse, New York hotel she named. When the Syracuse police arrested him, Gray first laughed at the accusation. Ridiculous, he said. He had ample proof that he had been in Syracuse on Saturday night. But when he realized that Ruth Snyder had confessed, he admitted taking part in the crime.
Dumbass. I would have been like, she took my stuff. She made it seem like it was me. I have an alibi.
I don't know you. He said, however, that he had not wanted to kill Albert Snyder. Gray claimed he had been coerced by his lover, who threatened to tell Gray's wife about their affair. By Tuesday, the front pages posted pictures of Gray and Ruth Snyder, along with the full text of both their confessions. Both had confessed. They each said the other had proposed the murder.
So let's say the story stopped here. Which one do you think it is? Let's say the story's done here. We have no more story. Who was the ringleader? I think it was her.
Oh, she was the ringleader. Yeah, he did the actual killing, just because, like, strength-wise.
If it ends here, this is how I see it. Mm-hmm. He's a dummy who got booty.
Yes.
Yep.
She hated her 12-year older husband, who was going to be in his 50s. She was still in her 30s at this point. She says, hey, it wouldn't be bad. We could be together. I'll let you do butt stuff if you get rid of my husband and you leave your wife and kids.
Men do dumb shit for pussy.
We've learned that on this show.
End of fucking story.
And women are evil geniuses, let's be honest. Like, they're going to take over the world one day.
100%. Yeah. If we ever commit a murder, Mike will go down for it.
Yeah.
And we want to thank our sponsor today, Disney, for all the great sponsorship here on Murder Mysteries and
More.
When
you wish upon a star, guys.
Queens District Attorney Richard Newcomb therefore obtained their indictment together as co-conspirators. Now, this is something that, whether it's 1920 or 2020, never changes. At the time, journalist Damon Runyon called it the dumbbell murder because it was just so dumb. And let me know, which I know you will, internet, how do you actually pronounce that? R-U-N-Y-O-N. Runyon? Runyon?
Runyon?
That's right.
He's Damon. Yet for almost a year, it received press attention far out of proportion to how important the murder was to society as a whole, says Maureen Beasley, a journalism professor emerit at the University of Maryland. Quote, these are not political figures. These are not people of importance. These were not celebrities. These were ordinary people. The driving force behind this coverage was a New York tabloid press war between the Daily Graphic, the Daily News, and William Randolph Hearst's Daily Mirror. To outsell each other, they latched onto stories with little relevance to public and used lurid details to draw readers in.
So nothing has changed in 100 years.
No. Things are better. The tabloids, quote, did not hesitate to make up details because there wasn't a strict adherence to facts by any means, Beasley says. Before Snyder and Gray, New York tabloids created a similar media sensation out of the 1922 murder of a reverend and a choir singer in New Jersey. In its coverage, The tabloid press turned Snyder and Gray into sensational figures straight out of a Hollywood movie. This was especially true of Snyder, who became the story's femme fatale. Nicole, you're a writer, and I feel ashamed for this. I could do an easy Google search, but what is femme fatale? Because I hear about, like, Nikita and a bunch of these different, like, awesome, like, women characters. What is it, actually?
A femme fatale, from what I know, is, like, a beautiful woman who uses her beauty to then, like, commit violence. So, like, the Black Widow, yes, she's a Black Widow, but she would also be considered a femme fatale.
Has Scarlett Johansson.
Have you heard, I was going to ask, have you heard that terminology in the pop culture
Avengers
film?
From Black Widow? Like, yeah, that's what I hear from Black Widow.
So, femme fatale, it's like when I was writing for my book, that's why I didn't make her a femme fatale. I don't talk very much at all about her aesthetics because it's a lot of what movies go to is that they're so beautiful, they're able to get away with a lot of things, or they use their womanly wiles, quote unquote, to convince men to do this stuff for them.
I like it.
I am for it.
You fucking would.
And here's the thing, too. It's interesting you say that because tabloids described her as a synthetic blonde murderess, a vampire wife, and most unusually, Ruthless Ruth, the Viking ice matron of Queen's Village.
Okay, say what you want, negative or positive. That's a great headline and name.
That is a great Avatar name and a great WWE 2K name. The Nancy West in an October 2005 narrative article. Gray also spoke frequently to the tabloids, painting himself as a victim. Before Snyder and Gray's trial even began, he described his affair with Snyder to the Daily News like this. Oh, this is going to be good. Quote, she would place her face an inch from mine and look deeply into my eyes until I was hers completely. While she hypnotized my mind with her eyes, she would gain control over my body by slapping my cheeks with the palms of her hand. This kind of coverage generated huge public interest in the case. I mean, I'm heated right now.
I fucking hate men.
I love this stuff, man. I'm all for crazy women.
This kind of coverage generated huge public interest in the case. Quote, 1,500 people packed the courtroom every day of the trial, while up to 2,000 people mobbed the streets outside, writes Jesse Ramey in the Spring 2004 Journal of Social History article. Hawkers sold fake tickets for $50 and souvenir vendors sold stick pens featuring a murder weapon. The sash weight for 10 cents. Get your murder weapon here!
I mean, there was not a lot going on at the time, so I don't blame them. This is entertaining.
Extra, extra, murder weapon here! We got it for sale! Oh man, I would love to live in the 1920s.
No, boy,
what day is it?
Again, I really don't think you would like to, Mike.
Sir, it's Christmas. It's not too late.
You're also Hispanic, so I don't think it would have been great for you then.
You're telling me I would have got to live like Scrooge?
No, you're probably the other guy making the railroad tracks for pennies, living outside.
I'm the one with the son with the missing leg.
Yeah, that's you.
Okay, got it. So, the testimony and the newspapers that eagerly reported it brought out the inherent drama of a situation that had culminated in a crime. The older, gloomy, ill-tempered, and dull husband, whose idea of fun was staying home and making artistic doodads, and the lively, young, party-loving suburban housewife, thoughtfully sewing slipcovers for the furniture and dresses for little Lorraine.
The Jetsons. They're talking about the Jetsons at this point.
In most of suburbia. The Mr. Nice Guy friend, a Sunday school teacher, fucking family man, traveling salesman for a corset and bra manufacturer, and member of the Orange, New Jersey Lodge of Elks, who took an interest in Ruth and became her lover. The bride postman, the coded letters, the afternoon lovers tryst at the Wolfer Astoria, while little Lorraine was dispatched to the fun of riding up and down with the elevator operators.
Okay.
That's a good time if you think about it.
For the record, I also looked up photos of Ruth Snyder and femme fatale, blonde vixen, like, really pushing it. Really pushing it.
She could do a lot of push-ups. It all added up to the inevitable need, said Prosecutor Newcomb, to get rid of Albert Snyder so Ruth Snyder and Gray can be together. But Ruth Snyder's motive was twofold. Unbeknownst to her husband, she had recently increased his life insurance to $100,000, and she was quietly paying the premiums.
Okay. So this is also the thing. It was just so easy to take out life insurance policies on people and up them.
Well, I don't know about opening them, but it's still easy to get life insurance for people.
I don't think it's easy to get it for someone else now. No, you can exactly. get it for yourself. Yeah. Like at this point, you literally could go in and say, I want to get my life insurance policy on my husband and never even really need a signature.
And then you fall out the window the next day and they're like, oh, here's your money.
Exactly.
There you go.
Yeah, he was looking at birds.
Yeah. Oh, no, he fell. Oh, no, $100,000. Hey.
Then
I'm crying to my singles.
Testimony brought out that Ruth Snyder had tried to twice smother her husband by disconnecting the gas range and nearly succeeded in killing him with the carbon monoxide by closing the garage door while the car was running inside.
Silent killer.
Had poisoned his whiskey so ineptly that he dumped it out and said he must change bootleggers. She had added narcotics to his medicine when he was ill. All without Albert Snyder suspecting her. Of course, because he's a dumb husband in the 1920s.
But it's also that they don't expect that women would be that intelligent to do it.
At that point, I totally expect
everything's bad for you at that point, too. The moonshine you're drinking is probably poison.
Yeah, already poison.
The nicotine's probably poison.
The guy who bootlegged it probably had sex with that barrel. So it's like, this is all bad. Yeah. This is bad times. An ironic footnote to the case was that the JG pin had been a keepsake of Albert Snyder's from his long-ago engagement to one Jesse Gashard, who died before they could be married. So it wasn't even Judd.
That's hilarious.
It was Albert's. Judge Townsend Scooter said a jury's task amid the conflicting stories of the confessors was to decide who had done what. The judge reminded the jury that Gray testified Ruth Snyder, quote, arranged the joint plan and jointly participated in the actual killing. While she testified that Gray was determined to take the life of Albert Snyder and that she endeavored to prevent him from so doing and that she was not present at the time Gray struck the blows. And she testified she believed she had dissuaded the defendant Gray from his alleged evil purpose. If the jury had much to ponder, so did the public. The tabloids were filled with analysis of the characters of the defendants. The Mirror hired a well-known phrenologist, one who studies the conformation of the skull based on the belief that this is indicative of mental faculties and character, to study photos of Ruth Snyder. So I don't even really care how to pronounce it because, like, bunk that guy. Like, that's some Nazi shit. His conclusion, her mouth was, quote, as cold, hard, and unsympathetic as a crack in a dried lemon.
Simpler times. Petra Schreiber remembers.
Yes. Natasha Rombov, a reporter best known as Rudo Valentino's widow, wrote, there is lacking in her character, that real thing, selflessness. She apparently doesn't possess it and never will. Her fault is that she has no heart. In 1 hour and 40 minutes, the jury decided to accept Gray's version. He had struck the first blow with a sash weight. Albert Snyder had groaned and turned, and Ruth Snyder had finished him off with blows of her own, after which they together applied the strangling wire and added chloroform soaked cotton for good measure. Both were found guilty and sentenced to death in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison.
That's a terrible name for a prison.
Yeah, and it's a really famous prison, though, uh-huh. East Coast.
Crazy.
In a macabre way, the verdict and sentence in Ruth Snyder's case was a milestone in progress toward equality of the sexes.
Of course they would make this the thing of equality.
We know this already.
The money is still different 100 years later.
Nicole, you can't get one without the other, okay? So you got to take what you get.
I still make 70 cents to the dollar. Well, so, you know what?
But we'll get murdered. Wait, if you and Mike murder someone, you both are going down for it.
The government will kill you.
So win-win.
Yes. Fuck y'all.
As a New York Times editorial summed it up after Governor Al Smith denied clemency to Ruth Snyder, equal suffrage has put women in a new position. If they are equal with men before the law, they must pay the same penalties as men for transgressing it.
And y'all better pay me the same.
No, don't get crazy. We got to start somewhere.
It was 100 years ago.
It was also significant that the two defendants, each of whom had confessed and tried to shift the burden of guilt to the other, were tried together, so that each was cross-examined by the other as well as by the state. A procedure labeled, quote, novel and dangerous by Ruth Snyder's attorney. Appeals were filed. One sought a stay of execution on the grounds that Ruth Snyder was a necessary witness in a civil suit to force three insurance companies to pay the benefits of Albert Snyder's life insurance to his daughter, Lorraine. Another appeal sought a habeas corpus release from unlawful confinement for Gray on the grounds that his constitutional rights had been violated by the joint trial rather than a trial of his own. Both appeals were dismissed. Ruth Snyder went to the electric chair at 11 p.m. January 12, 1928. She was the eighth woman put to death for murder in New York State. As the power surged through her body, a Daily News photographer in the reporter's pool crossed his legs, thus triggering a forbidden concealed camera to take an unprecedented picture. Quote, there were no cameras allowed in the room at Sing Sing Correctional Facility where Snyder's execution took place, but a photographer still snuck one in on his ankle. At the moment for electrocution, the photographer lifted his pant leg, pressed a shutter release in his jacket, capturing a blurry picture of her body shaking from the electricity. When Judd Gray was executed 6 minutes later, no one took a snapshot. Snyder and Gray were convicted. Both died in the electric chair on the same day in January 1928. The next day, the Daily News ran the photo of Snyder bound, masked, and dying on the front page under the headline, Dead.
Dude, that's not even creative.
It sold out in 15 minutes.
I mean, it makes sense.
That's fucking wild.
And if you guys look down in your notes all the way down, and if you look at the thumbnail of this episode, that is Ruth Snyder. What do you guys think?
These prison uniforms for women were crazy. Like, such a low-cut skirt going on here. Like,
I think that was just her clothes.
I think it was just her clothes. I think they went, this seemed like speedy trial, it seemed to be was an actual thing.
It's very scandalous then. Like, she definitely wore a very skimpy outfit for her.
No, it was the 20s. I think they were dressing like that already.
No, in the 20s they were dressing like that.
Were buttons that low right there?
Well, we don't know if it...
What about, like, the ladybug groups and stuff? Yeah, they all wore sundresses like that.
That's a little low of a V right there.
I think that's a weird thing to keep focusing on during the electrocution.
Alex, we don't want your opinion on that.
It's weird in general that, like... the uniforms of women or what she was wearing and they decided to choose a picture of this and she strapped in. Like, you can tell what they were going for by selling the sexiness of this. Like, look, we have death and it's a woman. Oh, this man died 6 minutes later. Now we don't got to take a picture of that.
But I also think, like, specifically, like, if you look at the picture of the headline, I don't necessarily look at the V. First, my first thing is I see dead. That's a lazy but good headline. And it's the eeriness of the picture. The picture is, it's a stillness, obviously. Like, photos are, the medium is a stillness of time. That picture specifically looks like it's constantly moving.
Yeah.
That's the illusion
looks,
of it.
It literally looks like a painting because it's so... it's moving so much.
So to me, it's like there's nothing aesthetically you even pay attention to other than the uncanny valley of, you know, that's a picture, but because of what's happening of it,
yeah,
that's the unnaturalness to it. It's almost a paranormal to me in that sense. Like, you're watching that veil being lifted.
Did she like the attention she was getting?
I would assume so. I think most of them did. And that's the interesting thing.
See, that's like overall package. I look at it, I'm like, this is a very, I guess that's what makes it eerie almost.
Yeah, I don't know if she liked the attention or not, but I mean, I think there was a lot happening at that time, and I think maybe she figured that her popularity in some ways with everything going on.
Well, they liked it because they were talking to the tabloids, so they enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Like, these are people from the 20s. Probably, it's not the same as if you did it right now, because you would understand that you can use that. Even if you did like the attention, you can use the idea of, I don't like the attention, as an attention grabber. Back in those days, they didn't have that mindset. There was paparazzi out there, flash bulbs going off, and like that's what it.
And perhaps it was also like, maybe they figured, we talked to the tabloids, maybe we'll see what happens, maybe we'll, you know what I mean? Like, they may not have thought that they were going to be persecuted.
Well, I mean, a lot of it too is that's different. Like, you could talk to Time magazine today and it doesn't mean anything. They're still going to put the needle in your hand. Opposed to back then where an outcry, we just did the Tulsa Race Massacre, where an outcry and enough people could get you out of something back in the 20s and the 30s. Like,
right.
It was different.
Right. Well, and also, again, it says she was the eighth woman. So that's not a lot of women that were electrocuted at that point.
Well, they were probably hanging them.
Yeah, well, but no, Bing just Hong in general, or... they had very low numbers in the beginning. Even sure. Now, like, women aren't executed as often, like, nearly as often as men.
Mm-hmm. Of course not, but there's also, a disparity thing, but, like, they're killing women all the time.
Oh, yeah, but I'm just thinking that what it might have been is she figured she might get jail for life and not necessarily the chair.
Oh, I disagree. I think they knew back then, if you killed somebody, you're getting killed. It's not like today where you could plea out or you could get manslaughter. You get one, two, or three in the degree.
Yeah.
Back then, it was like, she's a witch. Like, even in the 20s, like, they killed you for if you stole somebody's bread. Like, it's different. Like, they were killing people for any reason. They were killing you for being Irish.
It's like you said, like, you could take a plea and do this terrible crime, but if you plea out and save the court system a lot of time and money, you're serving life instead of getting the needle.
And it's also much more of a monetary thing in today's day and age, where they rather give you a lot of different pleas to keep you in the system opposed to...
Well, that's a whole subject there we can go down about the prison system and the money of keeping people in instead of getting them out or even putting them to death.
So women on death row have a relatively low chance of actually being executed, as there only have been 571 documented executions in over 400 years.
On this show, we stand for equal rights in death penalty, women, just so you know.
So they can go to death penalty, they can be on death row, but they aren't necessarily executed.
But I wonder if it's the same thing for men. Like, I wonder if the number of men that actually get executed in this country is high. Like, maybe there's a bunch of people on death row, and that in itself is, the life sentence is death row.
Well, we're also talking about laws change, and back then, every state, or most states, if not majority, you would have the death penalty compared to now, where only certain states have the death penalty.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I know that they do also say that 98% of people on death penalty, or on death row, are male. Only 2% are women.
Yeah.
So women just in general aren't as likely to be put on death row.
They're also not as likely to murder just in general too, right? Like, that's, even if it's a high number of women who kill, it's still not the disparity isn't there.
The amount of crime you would have to commit to be on that, to be in that situation.
Sometimes I wonder if the numbers are, I mean, the numbers definitely are different, but I also wonder, because I believe there are more males than females in general, like population wise, but also on top of that, I think women also tend to, it takes women a lot longer to get caught, it seems. And a lot of these, like, cases where you do have those few female serial killers, they've been able to get away for years without being caught.
Yep.
With that in mind, guys, what did you think of today's episode? Did you find any similarities between the way the mainstream media was handling things then as it does now? The way the court was kind of... going, because it's interesting, in court typically, it's interesting because if you listen to a lot of podcasts or a lot of different analysts, they say women get off typically more in plea deals and in cases where they're trying to convict both people. In this case, they went the opposite way. And I think that was a thing of its time where it's like, no, the man is right. The other one, she's hysterical. It's like, so it's, I wonder how much that plays. But what do you guys think?
The whole thing was really bizarre because it seems like, I feel like especially in the early 1900s, 1920s, that kind of area, you have a lot of disproportionate facts, right? Because women can be hysterical, they can be this, they can be that. But they also didn't find them fit to have like specific jobs or titles or make a certain amount of money. So it's like, it's a weird thing that happens where you have, well, we don't think that you're able to, you know, drive your own car or have a credit card in your name, because women could not have credit cards in their own name without their husband's permission until the 1960s.
Women be shopping, am I right?
Am I?
Okay. But you have this weird disparity because you have that, but then you also have, well, I mean, clearly she was the mastermind, and it's like, all right, so we're not smart enough to be able to do this, but we're clearly smart enough to do that. So like, is it just that easy scapegoat situation?
It's a sexy headline at the end of the day. It's a fun, I wouldn't say fun, it's a selling story.
Yeah, you can say fun. Go ahead, keep that. Say fun, go ahead.
No, it's fun for us to look back at it and talk about this, but I like the way Mike said it. We compare it to how we do media nowadays, and obviously it's a circus nowadays, and, you know, we have Twitter as most people's main source of news, so it's funny how things really haven't changed that much. I think, like, me and Mike talk about all the time where you had this age of journalism somewhere in the middle between back then and now, where it was a little golden age. You had a lot of nice stuff coming out, and then we kind of lost track of that again.
I had a good time doing this episode, especially after the seriousness that was last week's Tulsa Race Massacre. At least this time, it's a serious subject matter, but we got to explore different things and we got to be a little bit more loosey-goosey. And that's what I want to do on this new season of Murder, Mysteries, and More. Bring some heavy hitters. Also, just have some open conversation. Just bring some stories to the spotlight. And you guys can, maybe when you see it in your own different type of mediums, maybe when you see it on a TV show, or if you see it on some literature, or on another podcast, you heard it here first. But with that in mind, thank you all so much for joining us on this episode of Murder, Mysteries, and More. We appreciate all the love. For the lovely Nicole Mancha.
Goodbye, everybody.
For the good brother himself, Alex Mercado.
Adios.
I'm Mike Mercado. Don't forget to follow us all over the socials. She's at the Gone Missing Pod and at Typing When Tipsy.
Motorboat Magazine.
Yeah, Motorboat Magazine. He's at the Good Brothers Podcast. You can also find him at Mercado21Alex and at Good Brothers Pod. I'm at Mike M Media, at Mercado Airwaves, at Sports from the Couch, and all over this damn thing. Thank you all so much. Make sure you guys like, rate, review us, and share us wherever you get your favorite podcasts at Mercado Airwaves. And we have new merchandise. Good Brother, what new shirt do we have?
We have the When in Doubt Mercout shirt
at teespring.com/Mercado Airwaves. We'll see you all next time on the next episode of Murder, Mysteries, and More on the Mercado
Airwaves
Network.
Hey guys, Mike here from Mercado Airwaves. We want to thank you so much for all the support you've given us here on the network. And if you want to see what we're up to outside of the station, please follow us all over social media. I'm on Twitter at Mike M Media and on Instagram at Mike Mercado Media. You can follow the good brother Alex Mercado on Twitter at Mercado21Alex and on Instagram at Mercado2121. The lovely Nicole Mancha is on all social media platforms at Typing When Tipsy. You can follow the network on Twitter at Mercado Airwaves. Our pop culture show, The Good Brothers, on Twitter at Good Brothers Pod. Our true crime shows on Instagram at Murder, Mysteries, and More. And of course, like us on Facebook at Mercado Airwaves. You can see all our videos on YouTube.com/MikeMercado2333 or by searching Mercado Airwaves Network. We play video games on Twitch, twitch.tv/Mercado Airwaves Network. And of course, you can support our network by finding a tier just for you, whether you want early access, you want to be part of polls, you want to win contests. Prizes by visiting us at patreon.com/Mercado Airwaves. And we really appreciate it wherever you get your favorite podcast to like, rate, review, and share us. And please spread the word. For the good brother, Alex Mercado, for the lovely Nicole Mancha, I'm Mike Mercado. Thank you so much for all the support you've given us here on the network.